Hey, Dan, one of the things that we do, I used to hand address, you know, we were all trained to hand address everything when you're dealing with the leads that you get. What we did is I tested against that because I got lazy. We got so many leads that I want to hand address them all with all of our people. And we took a mailing label and we put the address in as a courier font. It looks like someone rolled it through their typewriter and printed and typed the thing up. And then we had, you know, the person it was from was another realtor. So realtors will open up something from another realtor. So it looked like someone typed up that thing. We tested against the handwritten one. I had no difference whatsoever.
It doesn't bother. So there's also the point very well made. You deal with this differently if you're using cold lists that don't know who you are versus lists that do know who you are. People who've requested versus haven't requested. Right. You know, the rules change.
Well, while we're on that subject, I want to learn something here as well. Has anybody at the table actually done a test of sending that personalized 9x12 opposed to one with a bunch of teaser copy on the envelope? Mike, you'd probably be the one to...
Yeah, I've tested it in the past,
You're talking about the blind list, though.
He's talking about a rented list.
Yeah, I'm talking about a rented list.
No recognition of you at all.
That works best for me.
You've done it to leads?
Yeah, for the last, you know...
We mean now, this is somebody who answered an ad and asked for information, and now the stuff is being sent to them.
Yes, so on lead-generated free reports, I used to send out hand-addressed, live stamp, all hand-addressed, and I went to, here is the report you requested, actually with a picture of myself, believe it or not, and we've even done meter mail with the return address, and it has not affected response.
Okay, so teaser copy.
Yeah, see, now my argument is as soon as you do that, you might as well junk the envelope up more and put testimonials on the back or put five bullets of what they're going to discover inside. Yeah. Because, again, as soon as you cross the line, why only cross the line a little?
Yeah, and to be fair, though, there's people that do very similar to what I've done and have found that it's dramatically decreased response. In a situation where I had to choose, if you're going to use the whole Gary Halbert thing, if you had to write a sales letter that someone had to open, and if it didn't work,
your life depended on it.
I would still always go to the personalized look, live stamp, hand addressing, do all that, especially if it's not lead generated. Which, since we're talking on the subject of direct mail, you know, one of the most important things you can do direct mail-wise is lead generation and send the people that have requested information. And I think we should also cover more multi-sequence mailings so people understand the value of just doing multi-step. Although you have mentioned it, I think everyone that's listening to this tape needs to know that if you have any promotion whatsoever that works that you have sent through the mail, be it a letter, a postcard, a big envelope, whatever, you should multi-step it. You should mail it again, and you should continue to mail it over and over again until it no longer works.
Well, sometimes you even, you know, when you structure a sequence, and so we just had this conversation off mic. I mean, when your results mandate it, you change your original plan. And so, like Michael's just done a mailing where the response, what the intention was mailing number one sells X, right? Now, mailing number two will do a offer change so that it's a smaller priced package. Why? The results from mailing number one are so good, we immediately know that if we just remail X again, we'll probably get a fourth or a half of what we got the first time, and that's going to be super profitable. So what was going to be the second mailing now becomes the third mailing, and the first mailing gets repeated. So it's the tracking, it's the watching, it's the responding to, it's the principle of responding to what the marketplace is telling you. And sometimes they'll tell you stuff that you didn't plan on hearing.
Yeah, I'd like to give an example too. Bill Phillips, when I first suggested that he multi-step sequences one particular mailing, he was selling supplements at 40% off. He had these three semi-trucks of EAS sports supplements parked outside the EAS facilities, and the whole promotion was, you know, my manager and someone else double ordered supplements, and we've got no place to put them, and we've got these three semis filled with supplements outside, and we need to get rid of them. So 40% off. And so he mailed this letter, and I suggested, you know, mail it a second and a third time. So that off the first mailing, if I believe I'm correct, he did $2 million in sales off the first mailing. Then he took the second mailing where put an X, handwritten, same letter, just mucked it up with fake handwriting, crossed out one of the trucks. We got rid of the supplements in one. We got two more left. and then did the second mailing, and then did the third mailing, and now by doing the other two mailings, he ended up doing an additional $3 million in sales.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all.
Now, see, what everyone's got to understand, it doesn't matter if you're a small operation, you don't deal with those numbers, or you're a huge multi-million dollar company. There's $3 million that were captured from that promotion merely because he took the same letter, put fake handwriting on it, which, yeah, some people could say that's very unprofessional. Doesn't matter. There's an extra $3 million that never would have been captured if it wasn't for that. Now, in case I'm not absolutely correct, it's between $2 to $3 million, but it is that because he sent me a fax that says this is what happened because of the multi-step.
More often than not, what that exact experience, more often than not, is that's almost the norm. Is step two and three will give you again what one did. So two and three aren't as profitable as what one was, but if one was profitable enough, in other words, my rule always is, if you'd be profitable at 50% of what you got from one with two and three, then you've got to do two and three. You just have to.
Especially because since that's the cost of the customer's already been borne to get them in the front.
Of course.
And also what a lot of people that hear this three-step sequence thing do, and I've done it myself, is you mail three letters, and it's profitable, and then for some reason you just stop. I can't tell you.
Three's got carved in skull.
The point is multi-step.
Well, we went around the table. You got seven. You got eight steps in your main sequence. I mean, we went around before. And I mean, at one point, Jeff and I in one business had 16 steps. I mean, the answer is how many steps until you get to the one that no matter what you try, it doesn't work. Then you know you went one step too far, and you back up one. But that's the only way to know.
Right.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Most people quit too soon.
Yeah, and even if you're not a direct mail, you know, expert, which some people think they have to be in order to do this stuff, if you have ever dropped anything in the mail and it was promotional, I mean it was profitable, then I would highly recommend that you do it again. Just
on the other side of that coin, though, if step one doesn't work, it's highly unlikely step two will work either.
Yeah. Without
occasionally
it
will,
it.
By the way, but it's very hard to multiply zeros. Now, I have seen instances where, like, if you take a three-step sequence, you're at, say, 1%, 1%, 8%. And all of a sudden, the back steps start to kick in.
But the listeners who are listening to these tapes, what would you suggest they do with step two and three if one don't work?
Completely retool it.
How about
completely retool
step one is so many times people screw up step one and quit.
Yeah, well, of course, and then there's the issue. If you did something, the other answer to your question is, if you do a mailing that you have every reason to believe was going to be effective and it's not, then the first thing to look at is if there was some real aberrant thing that happened to you, like the mail didn't get delivered, Desert Storm War broke out the week you dropped the mail.
Forgot to put the phone number on it.
Yeah.
Small
or date.
Yeah.
Forgot to put the dates on the seminar order form. That sort of thing.
Repeat that, Dan.
Then, failing that, you do the ugly work. You'll like this. Of getting on the phone and calling the prospect. I'm not calling to sell you a thing. We just got something that didn't work that we thought should have worked, and we really appreciate your help. Just, you know, we call the mail piece with you, and you tell me where we screwed up. You know, and you try and find some commonality. You make some calls and see if you can learn something. Yeah, you start.
I was just going to mention that I had a guy I sold a kit to that he called me up this year, and he said, he sent out this piece, and the same piece he sent out last year. And he said he tweaked it a little bit. He used some of my strategies to improve it. He got half the response. So I said to him, "Did you get your form 3602 from the post office to make sure they mailed it?" And lo and behold, when he finally got the form, they only mailed one third of the amount of pieces they mailed the year before. So typically, when the response is suppressed, you have to really look to the other reasons that they do it.
By the way, they'll tell me. I mean, I've had some people just, I'll say, we did exactly the same thing and we got different results. No, something's different. No, nothing's different. And you know, you got to beat them up and beat them up. And finally they'll say, well, yeah, we did take the picture off and put it on pink paper instead of blue paper, and we changed the type style, and we mailed it in January instead of April.
But outside of that, we didn't change anything.
Oh, all right.
Hey, yeah, let me, can I mention something about what he's saying? Yeah, just hold on there, big guy. you know, for everyone listening, there's a lot of people that are listening to these tapes that have purchased how-to information from maybe a lot of us in the room here. And I hear it all the time, I've heard it for years, that, you know, I sent out your letter and it didn't work. And they use this term loosely, like your letter, or I tried your promotion. Did you do it like exactly like we said? Absolutely. And almost 99% of the time, there's always that weird 1% where they might mail it out exactly and they may not get good response. But 99% of the time, they change something. And most of the time, they either don't realize that they changed something or they have somehow convinced themselves that although they have changed it, sometimes drastically, that it somehow is the same letter. And, you know, you got to take things in the proper context. If you change something that's been proven to work and you don't get the exact results, I mean, the most minor changes in the world could completely alter the response of a promotion. And so I want everyone that's listening to be completely aware of that. You start tinkering around with stuff that has been proven to work, and you don't get the type of results that we claim that you can get with this stuff, then it's not our fault. It's your fault.
Yeah, well, you're talking about envelopes. We did. I did a recruiting campaign for an insurance company for agents, and the ad is blind. You know, they don't know it's insurance when they're responding to the ad. It's an opportunity ad. And then they get sent a free report, right, which breaks the news to them that it's the insurance business on page 36, right? Guy says, are you okay there?
Yeah.
Guy says, you know, we got the thing. What's going on? You know, we got a bunch of leads and all that's good. We sent out all these reports, and now nobody has called us to make an appointment from the report. It can't be, right? It just cannot be. No, we did everything exactly the way you said it. So finally, FedEx me, you know, the ads that actually appeared in the paper, and FedEx me the report, et cetera, et cetera. They take, so it's a blind ad, and it's a report that doesn't reveal its insurance until page 36. Guess what envelope they sent it out of?
Insurance.
Yeah. Insurance company in the corner. You know, plain envelope. Well, we didn't have any plain envelopes. You know, you guys never heard of Office Depot? No, never heard of Office Depot. Yeah, all we got is envelopes with our logo on them. Yeah.
Yeah, and another thing is you can put together the letter exactly the way we show you, but then when people call, they completely screw it up on that end too. So I've had tons of situations where guys will be like, I ran your Yellow Page ad and it's, you know, it's not working. And you find out that they got, you know, 50 people to call the recorded message, but they never sent out the report. If someone called their office, no one answered the phone, or they got an answer machine, or a rude, untrained secretary.
There's almost always a reason.
Yeah. But the thing is, who gets blamed? The marketer gets blamed. You know, the one that's teaching them advice.
Some of them sensitive back.
No.
Yes. Yeah, you are a little touchy, aren't you?
Oh, man.
What else about direct mail?
Well, Dan, I did something. When I did that coaching letter, I dropped it. And it was my drop-down program, and my response really wasn't as good as I thought it would be. In fact, it was pretty bad. And I one day went to the office and said, call 100 of our people that you sent it to and confirm that they got it. And make the connection with 100. Don't just make 100 calls. Keep calling until you get 100 people. And we found that 42 or 43% of the people did not receive the mail. And then some of my people who dropped my mail at the post office said, there's some kind of postal guy out there who says, if you put your mail here, it's not going anywhere. And I started thinking, what the hell is going on? So I dropped the postcard, which I gave you guys, and that's after that I got 30 or 40 apps right off my website. So I'm thinking, some of my mail may not have been delivered. I don't know.
Folks. I can assure you that's true.
Yes.
Right. Finally, the horror stories of 10 years ago with bulk mail.
That's
been our experience. That it's not. It's now a lot of 10 years ago, Eileen and I used to mail a lot of bulk mail. But it took 6 to 8 weeks before it even got to the customer. And now it's happening in about 2 weeks.
So yeah, actually, there's good news, bad news about bulk mail, and here's what it is. The good news is the non-delivery problems with bulk mail, they're not gone, but they have diminished. Bad news is now they're not delivering first-class mail. The schmucks are throwing that out, too.
Yeah, it's almost just
so
that.
Violators are violating both now.
Well, you know what we're doing now? My last mailing for the boot camp, for example, went to 5 post offices and I dumped it in their bins.
Yep.
And I figured
we're starting to do the same thing, Greg.
Absolutely.
We're dumping it pieces, and we're dumping it ourselves, and we're dumping it in different locations just to make sure that it gets mailed. And even when we do that, it sometimes takes 6, 7, 8 days to arrive.
And we never do a single day dump. Some today, some tomorrow, some the third day. I don't want it all hitting the main Phoenix depot, even if it came from 15 different places. I don't want it all hitting the same night. I want to trickle it out during the week.
You know, another thing that I do is I use one of the monitoring services. So I've got these seated names, and every time I do a direct mail campaign, I put these names and make sure it goes there.
Yeah.
And if we don't get X amount of pieces back, then I know that all my mail didn't go out. But another thing, speaking of bulk mail, something that's worked really well for me is when you're selling a $20 or $30 product, I found it works a lot of cases better by selling it on an oversized postcard, 8.5 by 11 postcard, or even an oversized double postcard, where it's like an 11 by 17 sheet coated in half, and you can mail those bulk for about 19.5 cents each. The printing is really cheap, just pennies. So that's worked really well for me as far as selling a cheap product on the front end, or also for lead generation.
Well, now that brings me to a question here, and I don't know if this tape is the place to ask it, but I'll go ahead anyway. A lot of niche marketers, Dan, you know, we sell a small a $50 package on the front end that leads to a lot of other sales on the back end. Seems like a lot of niche marketers could benefit from that too, where you've got your main courses that you sell for $5,000-$6,000, but why not a trimmed down version, just like Ron LeGrand's book, that would sell for low dollar direct mail, so you could recoup some of that expense and then sell your packages through that smaller.
Well, you're really talking about self-liquidating lead. Anybody else welcome to weigh in too, but you're really talking about self-liquidating lead generation. And if you're in a niche, the question is, can that work, or will that work? Yes, it will, and yes, it can. The question is, is the niche big enough to absorb more than one front-end approach simultaneously without cannibalization? Whereas in a non-finite market like yours, you could run five different front-ends at the same time and you'd be fine. If you've only got 32,000 plumbers or whatever there are, you may have to think long and hard about that strategy. And that's why you see it used more in big markets than in small markets. Because in the small market, your thinking is, I'm going to get them all anyway, eventually, and I don't want to cannibalize my own marketing process by being a cheap date. In a big market where you can't get to all of them,
right,
you may run one starting with the A's and the other one starting with the Z's and let them cross and go back in the opposite direction.
That same kind of thinking is what we went through so often and still do quite often. We used to do workshops. Well, we still do workshops, but there's always a question, do we do them free or do we charge a little bit of money? And we tested both ways, and I quickly got out of the free workshop business. I just got so sick of that, of too many people coming in, too much money to get them that didn't have a reason for being there or we didn't really want them. And it's the same front-end deal. How do I get them? How do I best get them? Fortunately, in my niche, I can try so many things at once and nobody knows the difference.
Yeah. Dan, in lead generation, this is Bob Willis, what we're doing is we're generating leads to a select group. And one of the things that I see that's going to be very, very helpful is to use the telemarketing, because we're getting the lead in, but you don't have enough people to follow up if you get a whole bunch of them in. And the telemarketer follows up on the piece that you're sending them. Mm-hmm. And we're not doing that right now. And I bet you there's a whole lot of people in a smaller niche market like me that don't do that at all.
And you really want me to respond to that. I know you're just waiting for me to respond to that.
What do you think?
Did I say a word?
I will not do it. I will not.
Did I say a word?
No.
What else about direct mail?
He'll have an opportunity.
One more thing I'm going to throw out that I found is that if when you're doing direct mail to a list, the best day to drop is on Friday. And I've tested that, and I don't drop mail unless it's on Friday.
Because?
To any list?
Tuesday delivery. Well, that's when I'm sending first class. Well, because it's usually delivered on a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday.
I've had.
I found those were just the best.
Can you give us the results of these tests?
What's that?
How do you know this?
This was a couple of years ago. I tested mail-in on Friday, and I tested mail-in like on a Monday or Tuesday, and Friday works best, I found.
I've tested the same thing, and I've mailed on a Saturday or a Monday, wanting it to hit the office on Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday in the week, not hit on a Monday or not hit on a Friday with first-class mail. And I found that works the best.
Well, wait a minute. Are you talking local and he's talking national?
No, I'm talking national.
You're talking national.
Probably.
If it's local, I definitely mail on a Monday so it hits on a Tuesday or Wednesday. And if I'm talking national, I mail on a Saturday so it hits on Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday.
Problem is the post office is screwed up right now. You don't
know
how long it takes to get it.
I mean, on average, first class mail across the country is taking as long as 5 and 6 days.
So you're really dropping it on a Friday because and making
and
sure
it, get there
making sure it arrives a week from Monday.
Yeah, then next Thursday it may be there.
I guess one thing I would throw in about direct mail is, and it goes all the way back to the envelope design, is that you want to be careful not to have tremendous incongruency between the outside of the envelope and what they see when they open the envelope. So, for example, if you've done a pile mail, they better see a letter when they open up an envelope that looks like it ought to contain a letter. If the first thing they see is a full-color flyer, it's over. If you said personal and confidential, you better justify that inside pretty quick. I'd be damn well better not see personal confidential on the outside. You open up and says, dear Fairmountain homeowner, because now it's over. That thing's going right in the trash. So you went through all the work to get the envelope opened, and now it's over. And I see a lot of people mess that up. Anybody else?
So while you're on that subject, personalized mail will increase the response, always increases the response. Pain in the ass. Pain in the butt. But I have so much more response with personalized mail than I do with dear friend or dear anything, even though now it's not too difficult to get it done, but I guess it always hasn't been. But for a computer dinosaur like me, it was always so much of a problem and I didn't pay much attention to it. But especially if you're selling high ticket items, it's just almost imperative. I've got a copier now that will actually make copies and personalize them at the same time by downloading the names from a computer sitting beside it.
I've had a business plan for years that I've never gotten around to doing. One of these days, here was the plan. I'm going to publish Roger Magazine, the magazine for, by, and about people named Roger. Therefore, you could all the sales letters would be personalized because they would all start Dear Roger. And there's a lot of Rogers. My theory is every Roger wants to read about other people named Roger. And so we sell a subscription to Roger Magazine.
I think that's a
good
idea.
You guys like this?
Yeah. It can be done. I've got it.
That's
an Albert idea.
You know, I mean, the investment fund is now open, gentlemen. We all put it on.
I have a friend, Bob Jones, that gets a Bob Jones newsletter and meets once a year with everybody else named Bob Jones. So
in Twinsburg, Ohio, by the way, by North Hartfield Park, they have the National Twins Convention. And twins, no matter what your name is, but twins, small, and they have like 20,000-30,000 people show up.
Jeez.
For no reason other than to hang out with other twins. You know, and people are selling T-shirts and, you know, food and concessions and whatever. It's a big deal.
I checked into a hotel not too long ago, and a guy named Ron LeGrand called my room. And we got together. I mean, what's the odds of two Ron LeGrands checking into a hotel the same day somewhere in the middle of the country? It has to be. Who cares?
Okay. Two NSA conventions. Two NSA conventions ago, Danielle Kennedy and I were in the same room.
You want to elaborate on that somewhat?
No. Okay. Are we done with direct mail? Any last? Okay. Grabbers. Who wants to weigh in on grabbers?
So we're going
to
skip
the direct mail topic.
I've used them. And I know
you use them a lot.
Yeah. Just a $1 million bill one, for example. I did a direct mail campaign with a sales letter with just the headline, no $1 million bill, and then a sales letter with the $1 million bill. As you can see, I've attached a $1 million bill, blah, blah, blah. And the $1 million bill, same letter, same offer, everything. The $1 million bill version pulled 2-to-1.
Should we probably define grabbers?
Yes, we should.
Okay.
I've got a nice list of them. Band-Aids, aspirin, rubber bands.
Oh, wait, hold on. Define a...
Go ahead.
Okay, a grabber is an item or some
thing that you can attach to a letter or some type of anything that could create a lump in the letter that creates people to brings attention to it. You pull out a letter and there's a dollar bill attached to the top, a balloon, a Band-Aid, whatever, it brings attention, and it's almost like
it grabs
their attention. It's kind of like a little. It's a 3D headline in many ways.
Yeah. So it's not a pervert in a crowd, huh?
But does the grabber have to?
Depends on the crowd.
I'll think about that.
Well, first of all, it doesn't have to be attached. It often is, but it doesn't have to be. It could be loose in the envelope, but big enough or lumpy enough or whatever that it gets attention first, and then I want to read what this is about.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And Craig, does it have to be relevant?
Yeah. We're going to make it relevant.
Yeah, I think you make it relevant, you know. And I often buy them not knowing yet what I'm going to do with them, and then figure out what I'm going to do. Like this weekend, I'm going to Las Vegas to the ASMD show, and one of the reasons I go is to find this kind of stuff. Some weird item that I can buy a bunch of that either I or a client is going to use as an envelope insert or a grabber. And like right now in my office, I think I got 5,000 of them bubblegum coins. You know, they're made out of bubblegum, yeah. But they're wrapped like coins. Now, I have no earthly idea what I'm going to do with them, but they were available at the right price, and it's a money theme, and I use that a lot, so I'll get them, and then I'll figure out something to do with them.
Now, when Craig mentioned being related to the offer, you know, some people might think, well, if I'm offering, you know, a widget, it's got to be related to that widget. It could be related to the problem.
Yeah. Oh, well, in fact, more often than not, you're going to relate it to either the problem or the solution, the benefits. You're not going to relate it to the thing.
Right.
So, what
if I'm selling a furnace?
Yeah. I could use your Band-Aid.
Right.
Which is on your list for just about anything.
Right.
Because don't Band-Aid the problem. It's slang and everybody understands it. You can use it to sell a furnace. You can use it to sell a transmission repair. You know, anything.
I guess what I'm saying is you have to tie it in versus leaving it capricious.
The other is the old, you know, the picture of the good-looking gal in the bikini at the top of the ad that has no relationship to the ad. Then it says, now that I've got your attention, you know, let me talk to you about hemorrhoid surgery. you can get their attention with that sort of thing, but I agree with you. I think you then lose all the value you gained by making it, by not having it be connected.
Well, it could be
stunning.
You know, she had hemorrhoid surgery, and look how she looked.
Yeah.
Mike, you said you used $1 million bill and double your response. Are you talking to leads?
No, this was to a rented list.
Okay, you rented a list.
It's a whole rented list. Accurate test, right?
Yeah.
Everything else the same.
Everything was identical.
Except for the use of $1 million bill as a grabber and then the first two sentences that justify the grab.
So, Dan, do you think the grabber is that important to leads?
Yeah, I think it's important everywhere. I think in the sequence you can overuse it, and with the same group of people you can overuse it. But I think more often than not, certainly in the 60, 70, 80% range, you're going to get enough of a bump from using these things to more than justify the added expense of the item and the increase in postage.
So in other words, just because they order our stuff doesn't mean they're going to read it.
Yeah, well, what a great point. You know, most people mail, I think, with the assumption now that because they mailed somebody something, they'll go read it.
We're sitting around waiting on it.
Yeah, and they'll go
marking the calendar, waiting for it.
Which
to
is
arrive.
Not the case. Or we'll go to great effort to design the envelope to get the envelope open, but then forget about the fact that we got like 10, 15 seconds or so now. Because what they're doing when they open the envelope is they're really looking for an excuse to throw it out.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how you open mail. Think about, right? We stand there, we open our mail, and we throw out what we can. And then we look at what we can.
Immediately.
Right? Sure. So, you know, the way I always think about it is like my speaking gigs at the Peter Lowe deal. You know, when I come out on stage, everybody's leaving. If they're not physically leaving, they're at least mentally leaving, but most of them are in physical movement already headed towards the door. And I got that real short window of time, a minute, half a minute, something like that, to try and stop them and make them reconsider that decision. So same things with direct mail. We got a little window now to stop them from throwing them out and say, all right, maybe I better look at this. And so the question is, how do we do that? And one way to do it is with an interesting grabber. And it's a cheap way to beat a control. by the way, as a copywriter. If you get hired to beat a control, it's a cheap way to beat a control without doing much work. Because you can, just as you did, you know, if that letter was already working, all I got to do is add the grabber to it in the first paragraph, and I'm probably a hero. And by the way, as a consultant, you get paid just as much for that as you do rewriting the whole letter. So it's a good little trick to know.
Craig, I meant to say this yesterday, Craig, when you were talking about the surveys that you send out to your customers.
Yeah.
I've done that in the past, too. And with the survey, I will attach a little bag of Jelly Bellies, a little one-ounce bag. And then the PS, I'll just say, as a way of saying thanks in advance, I've attached. And that has really worked well. In fact, they'll send a survey back with a little note, thanks for the jelly beans or Jelly Bellies.
I'm kind of cheap. What I do is I tell them, I offer Dan's book, The Ultimate Success Secret. If you send it back, I'll send you a copy of this book.
Cheap. How much are the Jelly Bellies?
They're like 50 cents a bag, I think, or 30 cents a bag.
How much is the book?
It's $2.
You should be sending the Jelly Bellies.
No.
Shut up.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's not true, because he spends that amount on every letter he sends out. I send the book only on the ones that respond.
Or maybe you should do both.
Yeah.
Maybe you should do both. Therefore, and I'm a little more books.
Everybody else can start.
Just taking it a step further from grabbers, one of the things that we use in just about every direct mail piece we send out is a free gift offer. And we found that in many cases will double response. You know, it's sort of the old Sports Illustrated thing you see on television where, you know, more people want the sweatshirt than they even want to read the Sports Illustrated magazine. And a lot of times, you know, we get great gifts that we give out. And oftentimes, we'll even, if it's a really nice enough gift, and if it costs us a whole lot, we'll even tie it into a purchase. You know, so somebody has to spend $30 or $50 to get this gift that has a perceived value of that also. And it doubles response when you throw a free gift into the offer.
All Woody Allen said, by the way, the best things in life are free, and the cheesiest things in life are free with a subscription to Sports Illustrated.
You just made a valid point, though, Bill, inadvertently, I think. And that is that
most of my valid points.
Sports Illustrated build that empire by making their bonuses worth more than their offer.
Yeah. Premium drive the offer.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other grabber thing, which can tie into the bonus gift, is a lot of us underuse photographs. And a photograph can stop somebody and make them want to read the thing, particularly if it's a story that tells, yes, a photograph that tells a story. Or the photograph of the free gift. If all that's there, sometimes staple attached or a loose actual, you know, printed thing on paperboard, so it looks like the actual photograph.
We
scroll across it free.
We never do it unless we show a photo of the free gift. Plus, we underneath it, we put a caption that builds up the value of the gift. You know, talks about all the benefits and features of this gift and how much the thing costs, you know, at retail, et cetera, et cetera. You build that thing up, and half the people come in just to get the free gift.
And with that too, if you're sending an email, you can put on the envelope, as Joe mentioned yesterday, photo, red stamp and red, do not bend, photo enclosed.
And I can just hear people that are listening to the tape saying, okay, grabbers, where do you get them? You know, how do you find sources for grabbers?
You go to the
grabbers?
Store where he bought that stupid sun hat and the fart machine and the nose ring. He's got here. Yeah.
Do you want to go through and
place that? I can give him some ideas that are probably much better than yours. So
no, it's not even close.
No, go ahead.
I went to there's a store. There's a ton of these in Vegas. You know,
you're right.
And at the, I don't remember which hotel, but I asked them where they got their stuff. You went in there and they had miniature everything.
It's a money store.
It was in the Rio. I don't remember what it was, but I asked them where they got their stuff, and they gave me, she went over the cash register, pulled out, gave me five suppliers. You know,
U.S. Toy Catalog.
U.S. Toy.
Yeah.
Oriental Trading, which are both in the million-dollar Rolodex. There's three of those in them.
What's that coin catalog that you...
Educational Coin.
Yeah. I think it's educationalcoin.com.
Yeah, I think so, too.
There's a company called Lumpy Mail.
Lumpy mail.
Yeah,
some of this stuff, I mean, like Band-Aids, where do you get Band-Aids? You go to the health supply, you know, the medical supply store or Costco, Price Club, and buy them by the case. I mean, a lot of the good grabbers are ordinary, mundane items.
Like you could use Post-it notes.
Post-it notes
are great grabbers.
Constitutes as a grabber. You could use a button. and you go buy buttons by the...
Yeah, that was my point, to keep your eyes open.
You can, if you have dollar stores in whatever city someone's living in, those little dollar stores, they... First off, you can buy tons of stuff there. And if you want, like, several thousand items, you can normally ask them if they can get them. There's these little stuffed smiley faces, these little weird stuffed things with a smiley face and little arms and legs on them. And I got a quote on, 5,000 of these things from a dollar store. And if I buy them in quantities of 5,000, they're like 70 cents a piece.
Yeah. I mean, walk through a swap meet or a flea market or any of those kind of places, you go find something. What you don't want to do is like buy these for like, you don't get these confused with advertising specialties. That's not what any of us are talking about. Because now you got to put it through the nose, and the cost is not. I mean, you got to get these things cheap.
Sometimes you can make your own.
Sometimes you can make your own. Really.
Put an aspirin in a little baggie, for example, and if your house giving you a headache. That kind of,
we do that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a piece of string on the top of the letter, you know, so that they can tie it around their finger not to forget something or whatever.
Yeah, that's actually, since you mentioned that, Mike, that's one of the best collection letters that I've ever used and ever taught my clients to use, is when someone owes them money, is you send them a letter with a string that says, you know, I've sent you this, you haven't paid your bill and maybe you forgot, so I sent you this special string so you can tie it around your finger so you don't forget to pay the bill that you lost. And then 2 weeks later, if you still haven't got a bill, you know, I'm sending you some more special string because maybe you didn't get the last one and you really forgot to tie it on your finger. And I promise you, if you tie this string around your finger, you will not forget. It works.
Send them an aspirin and tell them, if you don't pay me pretty soon, I'm going to be a big headache.
Here's another one a client of mine used. If you do consulting work for someone, what do you get back from that? 1099, is it?
Well, not if I can help her.
Well, the service company goes, and when they don't pay them, they send them a letter with that form attached to them saying that if you don't pay me, then I have to turn this into the IRS for services performed. He gets a ton of the money in the next day.
There's also, you know, do we still have the promotional merchandise guide in the catalog? I don't even know.
Yes,
there's a whole book about this, by the way, in the Kimberly Hannity catalog.
And then in your resource directory for this year, you have a source for post-it notes.
Oh, yeah, customer printed post-it notes, which are good.
I've used it.
But, you know, people should be alert once they get this into their mind, if they're going to do a lot of direct mail and this is a technique they're going to use 3, 4, 5 times during the year, then you just want your antenna up and you're alert for it all the time, looking around, and, you know, if you're in a store or you're at a trade show or whatever, you're watching for these things.
Well, and your best customers, this is what, you know, we need to use grabbers more. Matter of fact, on the sheet here, we're going to test them for some other stuff, but we've taken some of our high-dollar seminars, and to our very best customers, we've spent like $10 per grabber just for our, you know, that's... there's only a few hundred of these customers that have spent, you know, mega, mega, mega dollars to qualify for this, to be on this exclusive list. But for those people, the sky is the limit. I mean, you know, it's that whole Ron LeGrand thing. It doesn't matter how much it costs you. It matters how much it's going to make you. And
did I say that?
Yeah, several times.
You got to write that down.
I must have been on the phone. I mean, you know, you can spend a lot of money on a nice grabber that's really going to make them feel good if it's a high enough dollar kind of sale that you're wanting to make and if it's a qualified enough customer.
Which loops back to list segmentation, which is your point. So you might send the same pitch to 4 different segments of your list and everything be different, but the quality, the cost of the grab, the elaborateness of the grabber and or the method of delivery.
Tell
so
us.
You might spend more on... You might spend FedEx on a portion of the list,
right,
and put a real dollar bill or a $50 bill in, and on the others you might be using the printed $1 million bills and be using first class mail.
Dan, you got the greatest example of that, how you filled your speaker's boot camp last year with that $10 package.
Well, that was a very elaborate package. It really, the whole thing was a grabber. I mean, it was a very elaborate box and the video and the audio. And we did a mailing for the copyright seminar where the sales letter was inside the toxic waste bag, the big plastic bag itself. And, I mean, that whole thing is designed to force somebody to open it. One of the things I'm dying to do, and I haven't found an application yet, but Omaha Steaks, if you're sending out a bunch of them, will insert whatever you want in with the package. And I'm dying to deliver a box of steaks to everybody with a sales letter fastened to the box of steaks. Hmm. You know, I just haven't figured out an application to do that.
Well, yeah, Dan, I mean, I'm thinking of putting on that multi-step.
No, see, this is list segmentation. And you guys, this portion of my list, I exert no effort whatsoever to sell you anything to, because either you've already prepaid for it or you'll buy it. So,
are you saying we're at the bottom of your funnel?
No, you're so far at the top.
Okay. I tell everybody there's no bottom to my funnel. I don't think you're ever going to get out of it.
You know, if I can restate what everyone else has said, but a little different way, I find that a lot of people, when they're doing a direct mail effort, they say, okay, I got like $5,000 to do this. So how can I make my $5,000 reach the most amount of people I possibly can? As opposed to saying, how can I develop a piece that will get the best response and maybe shrink the amount of people that I send it to? So just to reverse, I mean, we do a Thanksgiving card mailer every year, and we use, you know, it's a regular greeting card, and it's got the gold foil inside and everything. I teach this to my people, and one of my guys, he sent it to his printer, he made a real cheap card, and it was the envelope was real cheap and everything. He did not get a real good response, but he wanted to get out to more people. So, I mean, I told him, so next year, just shrink your non-people you mail to, but send out the real nice, high-quality card.
Right, you're sending out more, you're spending more money to reach less people,
right.
Less qualified people, less,
right.
More qualified people.
And that's a hard thing for people to accept, because they think the more people you hit, the better the chance you got.
That's a good question. Suppose you had only $5,000, and that's all you had to work with, and you're trying to crank up a business of selling information products. It would be a good thing to go around and find out exactly what we would do, knowing what we know, not knowing what we used to know, how to start that business.
Well, I think
I guarantee you, I would do nothing but generate leads. No way I would drop a mailing and hope that the list I bought was worth mailing to.
Yeah, I think I'd do a joint venture. If I had an information product, I'd go do a joint venture, so it costs me my...
I'd keep my $5,000. Yeah, I'd go figure out a way to get my $5,000.
Just in case it doesn't work.
You
need that $5,000. Joint venture, you get somebody else to pick up the bill is good, but assuming you don't know anybody.
I agree with your answer, and I totally disagree with your answer. So, personally, if I had to start over, I would do one of two things. I would do what you said. I'd spend a lion's share of the money on lead generation, and in a way that would generate a very small number of leads, and then send them a very expensive package and be prepared to do a lot of follow-up. I probably would too. In fact, under the circumstances that you just described, I'd be telemarketing.
No, no way you guys are calling.
Yeah.
No way. No.
Or my other answer.
You might get them during dinner.
Yeah, well, believe me. So the other answer is I wouldn't do any lead generation at all, but I would find the narrowest, most specialized niche I could possibly find and craft an offer and a pitch specifically for that niche and then mail to those people. I mean, I would find owners of three-legged pot-bellied pigs with white ears, who want to teach their pigs to sing and create how to teach one-legged...
and a lot of money.
It'd be that narrow.
Sounds like a big market there.
You'd be surprised how many pot-bellied pig owners there are, by the way. There's a guy working that niche and doing it very, very well. Bill Brooks talks about how it really is important. It's an important point about messages to market match. Bill Brooks talks about how our society is really made up of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of little subcultures, most of which... worlds and societies unto themselves, and in many cases we don't notice them unless and until we're involved in them. Kind of like you don't pay any attention to Buicks until you buy one, and then all of a sudden every third car you see on the road is a Buick. And so you would have no reason to even think about there being pot-bellied pig owners, and nor would I mean, I only happen to know because I know the guy working the niche. But there is a little subculture society. I mean, they have to shows, like dog shows and horse shows for their pigs, and they bring them, and they have Best of Show, and they have talent competitions, and there's a magazine, and there's two newsletters, and there's training tapes, and there's products, and all, and there's a zillion of these little subcultures.
And all of them have a chat room, I think.
Oh, they all got all of that. And we're all involved in at least one.
Right. And they all
we're all involved in something. Right. A lot of other people, it doesn't even go past their radar. And every one of those things is a market.